Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Things can only get podcast. Strike up the band! Straining at the leash, to be fair to Ed Miliband.
The only bed I've ever bounced up and down on.
With Elton.
With Elton.
I want a haiku next.
Clause 4 parties involving haikus.
It's just getting weirder and weirder, this. Yes, we're back. It's How to Win an Election with me, Matt Jolly, still joined by new Labour mastermind Peter Madison, Polly McKenzie's Policy McKenzie, former director of policy for Nick Clegg, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein. If you want to get in touch, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk or WhatsApp us 0333 003 2353.
Was that a yawn or a sigh, Matt? Before you said Peter's name, it was either a yawn or a sigh.
I think it was just a deep breath of anticipation.
Matt, talking about beds.
Yes.
It is now absolutely clear to everyone what really gets you up and out of bed a firecracker in the morning. And that's Liz Truss. You have a bombshell review of her book in The Times today on The Times website. Absolutely extraordinary. You explode every last remaining residual claim that she might ever have to greatness during her premiership. I mean, what is it about you and Liz Truss?
We used to get on.
You used to get on?
Yeah.
What happened?
We used to have lunch, go for drinks.
Really?
Yeah. But I'll tell you what happened.
Yeah, I actually
She became Prime Minister and she was absolutely disaster.
I actually helped her with a speech on the importance of the rule of law, and I now notice she's blocked me on Twitter, so...
Wow.
You're definitely dark state, Danny. I can tell you. You can just look at your...
I'm disappointed you're not wearing your Liz Truss dress, Polly.
I'm not.
Or, no. As it is Liz Truss Day.
I'm sorry. I did nearly wear it yesterday, actually, and then I thought better of it. Wore something else, more of a sort of Kate Middleton type dress that I happen to have. Mm. That's what I do. Is that I'm like copying,
dressing up as women in the news.
Yeah, I'm the chubby version of the women in the news. But my biggest encounter with Liz Truss was on her obsession with childcare ratios, where she wanted to have, I don't know, maybe this is libelous, 17 children looked after by every nanny. It wasn't like that, it was more like 6 or something. We, in the Deputy Prime Minister's office, Nick was really clear, he was sort of happy to compromise, but wanted to, you know, negotiate with her. She wanted 6, he was like, maybe we'll go to 3, maybe we'll go to 4. And she came in to the office and basically said, I don't recognise your authority. I'm a Conservative minister. I report to the Education Secretary, not to you. So you have no say over the matter. So Nick dug his heels in and didn't let her reform anything at all, which showed her brilliant political strategic genius for how to negotiate successfully.
I don't recognise the authority of the Deputy Prime Minister.
No, no. But anyway, maybe...
He went full Jackie Weaver and said, I have the authority. Yeah. Well, on the subject of Liz Truss, because she's back with her book, 10 Years to Save the West. Here is a little excerpt from Liz.
In my acceptance speech on being elected leader, I'd ended with a declaration, we will deliver, we will deliver, and we will deliver. From the outset, however, delivery turned out to be a problem. This was literally true, as my husband discovered when he tried to get our usual supermarket grocery order delivered to us in our new home. First, he had to convince Ocado it wasn't a hoax and that, yes, he really did want it delivered to 10 Downing Street.
Right, so for the sake of clarity...
Is that Liz Truss?
It's not actually Liz Truss. I mean, extraordinarily, she's not cooperated with us. They've been read for us by Noreen Skinner, who is an impressionist. But that is word for word.
Is that the book?
That's a genuine excerpt from the book.
It's probably been, like,
no.
Shrunk.
No, that's, no, that's completely right. No. The right. line, we will deliver, yeah. deliver, but from the outset, delivery turned out to be a problem. That is literally what she writes in the book. So, on the subject of Liz Truss, we've had a question.
We're all speechless here.
Well... That's the first thing. What if Liz Truss's premiership hadn't happened? We've had this question in from Jonathan.
Hi, Matt. Hugely enjoy hearing about historical elections from the panel. One previous election seldom mentioned on the podcast is the one that took place in September 2022. So, how do the panel think the polls and the country would look if Rishi Sunak had beaten Liz Truss at the first time of asking in the Conservative leadership election?
Go on then, Danny. What do you think about that?
You can put the bell away on this occasion because I think it was very significant.
It made a difference.
Okay, this is for two reasons. One is that I think the economy makes a big difference, and the other is because leadership makes a difference. And the way that people look at both, they do look at their view at the end, but they also look at their view at the peak. And the Liz Truss premiership, in my view, was the peak experience. So a bit like with John Major in 1997, they could never really recover from the ERM disaster. That was the peak. And it was had a very strong influence. And even though the economy got better as they got closer to the election, they couldn't overcome that. And I think the same, the Liz Truss premiership destroyed a crucial part of the Conservative case, which is that the Conservative Party is prudent with public money and can look after the economy. And people are willing to accept that the Conservative Party can't always be as expansive as they would desire on public services and spending, because the trade-off is the Conservative Party is prudent and hard-headed about money. When the Conservative Party appears irresponsible, there then becomes no reason to vote for it. And so I think it was a calamitous event. And it not only was a calamitous event in the life of this government, it has at least the capacity to be of long-term disservice. It could be an ideological disaster for the Conservative Party, a bit like Dennis Healey turning round in the airport in 1976 or the rubbish piling up in the streets in Leicester Square during the winter of discontent. It has that capacity to be a long-standing problem. And I think the Labour Party will still be talking about this premiership way into the future. And it wouldn't have happened if she hadn't been elected, because Rishi Sunak would not have pursued that policy, yeah.
The fact is that the Labour Party, of course, though, won't be talking about it as much as Liz Truss herself will be talking about it. And that, of course, is the huge dagger at the heart of the Conservative Party's election chances, because to have her popping up now, what, every other week with one thing or another, denouncing this and attacking that and undermining Sunak's authority. I mean, Danny, do you think, and I agree with everything that you've said, but do you also think it's a personal problem for Sunak in the sense that he's never been able to defeat the Liz Truss wing of the Conservative Party? Yeah. I mean, she won against him in the first round, and then in the second time when he came back for the leadership, you know, he won it without an opponent. So he's never been able to demonstrate convincingly to the public that he's in charge.
Look, throughout the 1974 to 79 Labour government, and then beyond that into the 1980s, there was an ideological battle inside Labour about what was the cause of their problem. Everyone could see there was a problem. But some people thought that the issue was that the Labour Party hadn't been left-wing enough, and some people thought it had been too left-wing. And there was a clash over that, and Tony Blair ultimately managed to go beyond that, find a formula for going beyond it and move the party in the right direction. And I think the Conservative Party is in exactly that position now. My view, as you know, is that it was very important after two disastrous ends to office, Boris Johnson's and Liz Truss's, which had entered in different kinds of disaster. The Boris Johnson one over issues of integrity and governance and the Liz Truss one over issues of the economy, after two of that kind, the next leader of the Conservative Party had to try and draw a line, provide an analysis as to why he was different from that. And Rishi Sunak either correctly or incorrectly decided, you know, he was going to govern the party rather than the country. And that was a mistake, in my opinion. But he maybe thought he couldn't win that battle.
Did he have any agency in that, do you think, Polly? Or was this the very act of coming after Boris Johnson and Liz Truss? But, you know, when you've got ethics and economy both doomed, what was there anything he could have done, do you think?
I think, actually, if he had come in without Liz Truss having been the intermediate leader, I think he would have been more able to distance himself from Boris Johnson. But for me, the we're talking as if Liz Truss winning was a sort of an accident. Actually, Liz Truss won that election because of a fundamental problem with where the Conservative Party is. It was the Conservative Party that chose her, despite the fact that it was clear for, I mean, years and years that she was essentially a sort of magical thinker who was overpromising and sort of jumped up on a particular ideology and not really a deep thinker. I mean, you know, one of the moments that sticks in my mind was when she was arguing against having a second referendum on Brexit, and she said, "Oh, nobody's ever changed their minds," and the interviewer was able to say, "Well, except you," because she was on the Remain side and flipped to the Leave side, again reasonably given that the referendum had been lost. But that's the thing, is what Brexit did to the Conservative Party is break its historic link with conservatism, because the magical thinker type of economists were allowed to kind of just divorce themselves from reality and make these sort of fantastical promises. Boris Johnson himself was, of course, promising, "Oh, I can totally redesign the economy and spend huge amounts more on the NHS, on defence, and I can reduce your taxes." No constraint, no conservatism. And when you've got a party that has enabled itself to think like that, and a party that still, you know, huge numbers of people still sort of in love with Margaret Thatcher, which therefore can be sort of somebody cosplaying Thatcher without any sense of the seriousness or the depth or the time it took her to achieve anything, sort of, I don't know, feels like a sort of Pavlov's dog reaction, that this indulging a fantasy. And that's the problem, is Liz Truss is not just, Liz Truss wasn't a very good Prime Minister, it's Liz Truss was selected as the Prime Minister because the Conservative Party is stuck in fantasy. Until that is fixed, nobody could really be a good Conservative Prime Minister.
You're completely correct, Polly, and a crucial point of this is that if Boris Johnson had not fallen over the parties, he would ultimately have removed Rishi Sunak and attempted the Truss agenda himself, with exactly the same consequences, and he might then have fallen in a rather than her. This is an agenda that isn't just one that she invented, which is this idea that it's a long-standing one. It's the Laffer curve one, which Margaret Thatcher rejected, and you know, for years into the future, it will be Labour's intent to label this group of policy proposals, particularly the idea that if you simply cut taxes, you can grow fast enough to pay for all your public spending ideas, as the Truss agenda. And, you know, she is in some ways doing the counter case to this a favour, yeah. Right? Every time I see her doing it, I think, well, that's not helping Rishi Sunak's election chances. But it is ultimately helping the longer term cause of Conservative sanity, because it is attaching these fundamentally unrealistic ideas to an obvious failure, which is her premiership.
And actually, one thing that's happening right now is that Rishi Sunak has got this vote in the House of Commons, we're talking Tuesday morning, on the phase smoking ban. Liz just says it's unconservative. And I spoke to someone who said the whips and ministers are literally going around saying, "Do you want to be in the lobby with Liz Truss?" You know, the idea, the sort of the libertarian argument is being tainted. There are lots of Conservative MPs who think that, you know, government doesn't need to keep going around banning things. But you are going to be in the lobby with Liz Truss. And, you know, if she turns up, she might be busy plugging a book. But that, you know, she's damaging the very causes that that wing of the party want.
That's true, but she's not really concerned about the here and now, is she? She's not playing for today or this week or next week. She's playing for the election and what happens after. And it seems to me that it must be in the interests of Liz Truss and her wing of the Conservative Party to see their own party go down to a terrific defeat so that they can say, well, there you are. You know, you didn't follow our ideas, you didn't adopt our policies, you didn't see through Brexit and implement it properly, you didn't give my tax cut policies a chance, and look what's happened to you. You know, terrible defeat. And I think they will be working for that defeat from now to polling day. Isn't that the logic, Danny?
Well, it is. It's the Bennett position
it
as well.
It is the Bennett.
And,
yeah.
And there's
the Bennett or the Corbynite, you know, yeah.
And I think that that is exactly what she is proposing to do. But I, you know, her biggest problem when she was in office was reality. And her biggest, the contest with reality, not the contest with other Conservatives. And she blames her defeat on all sorts of reality-based institutions like the Office for Budget Responsibility. And so her biggest problem after the election will remain that, right? And the people who she may indeed capture, a diminishing group of people in the Conservative Party, but it will not succeed until it turns against those things. And it will always have her failure to carry round. So I cannot see how, if... You know, I do think one of Liz Truss's objectives is to herself be, I don't think she's doing it in a kind of disembodied ideological way. She sees herself as the tribune for this idea, these ideas. She's always seen that. And it's amazing to me that she cannot understand that she drags those ideas down.
But Danny, we are about how to win an election in this podcast. And what I don't understand is who and where the constituency of voters is in the country that wants to connect with Liz Truss's libertarian ideas.
Well, no, I think there are some people that just don't want to connect with Liz Truss.
Well, even so, Matt, I mean, okay,
we should leave the ECHR or cut taxes.
Tories.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a constituency of voters in the country. Now, I know there are voters, you know, who feel very anti-European, anti-immigrant, anti-this, anti-that. And the Conservative Party is very worried that those voters will go to Reform UK and will siphon votes off from them in the election and cause them, inflict an even worse defeat on them. But you see, Boris Johnson wasn't a libertarian in 2019. He was a nationalist in the sense that he was an anti-European who said, you know, much to everyone's relief, I'm going to get Brexit done and put the last 3 years behind us. And people were relieved to hear that. But he is also a sort of socialist, as I've said before. You know, high spending, intervening, levelling up, doing this, doing that, going around the country, making all sorts of promises to people. What I don't understand is where these voters are that Liz Truss thinks she connect with. I don't think they are small state, anti-government, libertarian... No. Get off my back. I think there are people actually who want to be protected.
But there are
not exposed.
There are both kinds, right? There are anti-immigrant nationalist libertarians and there are anti-immigrant nationalist socialists. And what the Leave campaign managed to do was pull those two groups of people together as a shared constituency, despite the obvious inconsistency between the views of the tax cutting and the public spending rising.
Perhaps you've got to define what we mean by libertarian then. I mean, libertarian to me is just let everyone do their own thing. Get government off your back. Shrink the state, cut taxes, and just let everyone do what they want. I don't think that
libertarians
is what,
always want a police state as well.
That Red Wall, I don't think Red Wall voters in 2019 were voting for that. I think, if anything, they were voting for more protection.
But
they wanted a government that was on their side and talking to their interests in different parts of the country. And they felt they had been completely abandoned by Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. And they were looking to Johnson and his great personality and his swashbuckling demeanour to come to ride to their side.
Well, we'll see if Liz Truss does connect with any members of the public. There's a stat I've used before, but 10% of people are positive about Liz Truss, according to YouGov, which is the same
as
number of people
as 10%.
Who are positive about North Korea. So there we are. Right, up next, we are going to take a look at expectation management as we head into local elections next month, but then also the general election. What do you do if you're miles ahead to try and manage expectations, make sure people come out and vote? And I'll also give you details of how you can come and see us live the morning after the local elections. We'll do that next here on How to Win an Election.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Now, if you want to come and see us recording the podcast live the morning after the local elections, you can come to Times Radio Towers in central London, Friday, May the 3rd. You'll come and see us live. You can only come if you're a Times subscriber, though. So go to mytimesplus.co.uk, click on events, enter the ballots, and hopefully we'll see you then as we... Apparently, there will be coffee served. So I don't know if you're all doing that. I don't know if that's the... A big teapot, Peter.
Yeah. Ground beans, beautiful, fresh coffee, yeah. Italian style.
Do you own a milk frother? I bet you own a milk frother.
Look, to be precise, there is a milk frother on the side of my machine.
Yeah.
But I've never worked out how
to
use it.
That's like Bill Clinton's. It's Bill Clinton's response on smoking marijuana.
Anyway, mytimesplus.co.uk if you want to come and see us. That is the morning after the local elections, mostly happening in England. There's some in Wales as well. So we thought, looking ahead to that, how do parties manage expectations, both of the press, the public, and inside their own parties as well, so people don't get carried away? How does the assumption that one party is massively ahead affect the campaign as well? Is this what happened in 2017? We had this in from Adrian.
Hi, Polly. Love the podcast. A shout out also to Danny, Peter and Matt, who provide great support. Now, there's been speculation that were the Conservatives to suffer a terrible night at the polls on the 2nd of May, that the PM will face a confidence vote by the parliamentary party. In response, it's been suggested he could call a general election. Could that happen? And if it does, could the King refuse his request to dissolve Parliament? Thanks very much, Adrian Jenner.
What do you think, Danny?
That latter suggestion, which is that he could call an election and that there'll then be a decision that by the palace that not to accept this election, I don't think that would happen. I think they wouldn't intercede in politics in that way. So if you called an election, there'd be an election. And I don't think that anybody would call an election in those circumstances. A small possibility is that he might not, if there was an attempt to remove him from office, he might just go. I don't think that's absolutely impossible. I think it's not what I expect to happen, but not absolutely impossible. Small but real, I would say, as a chance. But the most likely thing is, if there was such a challenge, again, something that I think is definitely possible, but probably won't happen, then he would fight it and see it off. That's what I think would happen.
There's no world, I mean, you know him better than anyone here, there's no world in which he concludes that someone else could do a better job and he voluntarily goes.
Well, I'm just saying, if he was challenged, but not that he would think someone could do a better job, but he could just be fed up with it. I've no reason to, just to be clear, in order not to set anything going, I've absolutely no reason to think that's true. It's entirely speculative.
Yeah, okay. Peter, this idea of one party being miles ahead and what that might, the impact that might have on voters, and the suggestion that, like, particularly in 2017, Theresa May was so far ahead, Labour MPs went around saying, oh, you can vote for me. Even though Jeremy Corbyn's not going to be Prime Minister, she doesn't deserve a big majority. Do you think that does have an impact?
I remember in 1997, when we were sort of miles ahead in the polls, Philip Gould, our great strategist and pollster, delivered a thunderbolt to the campaign team in Milbank the weekend before, called us together and said, I've looked at all the research and I've got bad news. Our Polish lead is shrinking. Economic optimism is on the rise. John Major's approval ratings are also going up. Our focus groups now are not talking about a close-run thing, certainly not a landslide. We have got a big job on our hands in the coming week. And my God, did it send us an electric shock up us. And I think that was probably what was intended. I mean, it is the case that we were, the lead was going down, as it will do for the Labour as we get into the election campaign this year, whenever the election comes. It always does. And so there will be tremors. But Philip delivered this sort of great, dirty, great shock to us, told us we had to get back in touch with the voters' real feelings and not take anything for granted. And of course, we didn't in the final week and did indeed get a landslide majority of 179 or however many it was. So it works within a party. But the I remember when I was campaign director in 1990, the legendary expectation management by the Tories was undertaken by Ken Baker, the then chairman of the Conservative Party. And the Conservatives were very unpopular. Mrs. Thatcher was very unpopular in the country. And Ken Baker went round telling everyone, oh, we're going to receive a terrible trouncing in the local government elections this May. But quietly, in the week before, he started pointing journalists towards two boroughs in London where they'd done their own private polling and discovered that they were in all likelihood going to retain them, and said the big litmus test of these elections is going to be Westminster and Wandsworth. And then on election night, of course, they did retain Wandsworth and Westminster. Ken Baker was first out of the trap saying, my God, this is absolutely remarkable turnaround in Conservative fortunes. And that is, of course, the point. You know, you set your expectations of an election in order to influence perceptions of the result after. And every party does it. It is part of the great game of politics.
A load of absolute rubbish, though, this whole thing is. I can't believe it.
Rubbish that it happens?
Yeah, no, rubbish. The idea that this expectation... So let's just take this Ken Baker example, yeah. Right? It's certainly true that he influenced the reporting, moving the reporting from accurate to inaccurate reporting as to what had actually happened. Thus, as a result, he must have increased expectations about what might happen at the next general election. So...
I think you're overestimating the ability of journalists to fall for the twaddle. No,
yes, but well, I'm not over. I'm that.
Yeah,
so,
but Danny,
it
was a ploy to help save Mrs. Thatcher, failed, and
yes,
she went later on in the year.
It didn't even succeed on that basis. So, as a story about internal Westminster politics, the way that things move within parties, motivating people, and that makes a difference. But as a story of what happens in elections, no, it's ridiculous.
Sorry to interrupt the squabbling. You're really...
I'm afraid it is a feature of politics.
Well, Adrian loves your podcast, Polly. Go on.
I love Adrian. I think all of these things are true, right? So the expectation management has got to the point of being not, you know, sort of inside baseball of inside baseball. It's where we are asking about whether the expectation management is leading to the management of expectations. And so you just get into this circular thing. So now we're talking about whether Ben Houchen holding on to his mayoral position will mean that everything's fine for the Conservatives. But I mean, of course it won't mean that everything's fine for the Conservatives, because as Danny reminds us regularly, local elections don't really tell you much about what's going on that you couldn't find from the polls, and they are often, particularly because of the distorted reporting that comes from expectation management, really less useful as an indicator of public opinion than the polls. But as Peter says, actually it matters because of internal motivations within SW1, within how motivated do your campaigners feel? How do they cope? And so the expectation management on the night, which shifts the reporting, can change the mood, not just of Westminster journalists, but also your backbenchers, who are just as likely to fall for the spin and all of that, however jumped up it is. And so if you are thinking about how do you get through the first 24, 48 hours so that you don't trigger a leadership election, then the expectation management does matter. It doesn't influence the voters. However, there is one thing that hasn't come up, which is the thing that does really influence turnout is the sense of whether it's going to be a big win election. If it's a foregone conclusion, then fewer people turn out. There's always higher turnout in close-run elections. And so if the voters think one party will definitely going to win, then on both sides, if you think that Labour going to win and you vote to, why bother to turn up?
And I'll give you an example. Labour side. I'll give you an example of where I think that happened. It was expert manipulation of expectations, and that was in 2015. David Cameron against Ed Miliband. And Labour went into that election with a sort of fairly healthy lead, which David Cameron then started to talk up and said, you know, we could be heading not just for a hung parliament, but Labour Party led by Ed Miliband being the largest party, supported not just by Liberal Democrats, but because he had spotted what was happening in Scotland and the rise of the SNP at the expense of Labour in Scotland. He said, you'll have a minority Ed Miliband-led government supported by Liberal Democrats under the thumb of the SNP, and that led directly to that famous Conservative Party advertisement of Ed Miliband in the top pocket of Alex Salmon, etc. Now, I think that was a very effective manipulation of expectations, and he certainly went up and down the West Country frightening Liberal Democrat voters to death about the prospect of Ed Miliband being under the thumb of the SNP, and drove many Liberal Democrat voters in straight into the arms of the Conservatives. And of course, what happens? He turns up with a majority.
Yeah, but that's actually not what happened, because David Cameron was claiming he would get a majority, and David
needed a majority.
What happened is that people correctly estimated that there was a huge chance we'd have a Labour SNP, SNP coalition. So, by the way, you know, you can see why with Polly's statement, you can see why Nick Clegg won the debate. It's because your position was obviously a reasonable.
I agree with Polly.
I do agree with Polly.
We agree actually. With Polly. So I agree with Polly. I think that if you look, let's have a look at this local elections. Clearly, there's an element in it that's going to affect whether Rishi Sunak is able to continue all the way through to October and in what state he was. That relates at least somewhat to the reporting and MPs' reaction to the reporting. I think that the ability of MPs and parties actually to manipulate expectations, except in particularly after everyone realised they'd fallen into a trap with Kenneth Baker, and therefore there's less inclination to do
most
it now.
Most people weren't alive almost in 1990 as well.
Yeah, so I just think in terms
in
of
lobby.
Determining the outcome of elections as opposed to the internal politics, expectation management, you know, what Philip Gould said due in 1997, it did not actually affect the election. I would even query the question of whether or not Labour's vote was declining in that period, but that's a conversation for another time.
It had already disappeared? How do you mean? Well, our lead did decline.
I think what simply happened was the measurement of it declined, but it was always roughly
the measurement.
Large. Danny thinks everything's noise.
Noise, political
tinnitus that Danny experiences.
Well, lots of it, not everything. This is a very important distinction.
So on this question of expectation management and what impact a big lead might have, I got in touch with Phil Cowley because he knows about these things and he writes books about elections and he's an academic. And he said that the actual suggestion of it having any impact on people's votes, he thinks, is limited based on the British election study. But there are two impacts of a big lead. One is that if Labour have a massive lead, then there'll be much more scrutiny of them. And the Tories seem to be miles behind. There'll be very little scrutiny of the Tories. So while Labour wants to turn the election into essentially a referendum on the Conservatives, they will reach a point where all the attention is going to be on the Labour Party, which could have an impact. He also says that, as happened in 2017, as Theresa May's lead did start narrowing, you get the sort of, he says, a sort of anti-momentum. That becomes a negative story in your own right. So if there is lots of attention on the Labour Party and the lead starts narrowing, depends when it happens in the campaign, it starts becoming a story in its own right that things are stalling and he might fall short and all of that. How big a risk do you think that is for Keir Starmer, Peter?
Well, it's a possibility. I mean, you talk about 2017 and the main outcome of that was that Jeremy Corbyn drew completely the wrong lesson or conclusion from that election. He thought he'd done incredibly well and that Labour's share of the vote had gone up. In my view, because people were rerunning the referendum, the Brexit referendum, and they were got behind Labour if they were all Remains at the expense of the Liberal Democrats. But he thought this was a vote for socialism, so that he went into the 2019 election very much, you know, himself the victim of his own expectations. He thought that he'd done so well in 2017. He'd take Labour's manifesto and sort of double every commitment that we were making and halved the credibility of the manifesto in the process. And, of course, the prospect of him coming to power on the back of this manifesto terrified everyone, an enormous number of people, and his vote collapsed.
But Philip's point as well, Polly, was that there wasn't much scrutiny of him in 2017 because it looked like Theresa May was going to walk it. And then suddenly everyone sort of overcorrects. Actually, he repeated most of what he said in 2017 and 2019, but there was certainly much more scrutiny.
And they did focus on him in 2019.
But I think it was partly scrutiny. I think he was actually just better in 2017 as well. Like, he put on a suit and he... I remember there was a sort of question time type debate with Theresa May first and then he came on afterwards. And he was sort of relatively moderate and reasonable on Trident and he didn't... He didn't sound very socialist. He sounded absolutely like left-wing and ambitious and radical, but there was something moderated about his positioning. And I think he had listened to advisors who told him that he had a really tough gig on his hands and he needed to save Corbynism by not being destroyed. And as Peter says, they then took that as not as, oh, that advice about trying to sound relatively moderate was good advice.
It was right.
they took, I guess, the more Benite view, which is that the moderation is the reason we didn't win.
Yeah.
And that they abandoned
and that
the moderation.
These people had voted for socialism and that therefore they could go hell for leather and throw the book. Yeah. You know,
well, they also thought they'd won for quite a long time, which I found quite weird.
Well, as I know, as I accidentally told Noam Chomsky once that Jeremy Corbyn didn't win the 2017 election, we fell out.
You're so boring.
Here is a question on this subject then from How to Win Election listener Keith.
Good morning. This is Keith from Brentwood in Essex. Really enjoying the podcast. My question is, given how unpopular the Conservatives now are, do you think a Labour Party still led by Jeremy Corbyn would win a general election in 2024?
What do you think, Danny?
No, I don't. So leadership ratings are not absolute, they're relative. And Boris Johnson, even at the height of his popularity, wasn't, as leader, he wasn't that popular, but he was more popular than Jeremy Corbyn. I think after Jeremy Corbyn had taken the turn beyond 2017, which was, as Peter said, probably the left vote came together because of Brexit. After that, I just think it would have got worse and worse. I mean, it's difficult to do this counterfactual completely, but I just don't believe an election can be won from the position that Jeremy Corbyn took up. And the longer he'd gone on being leader, the more clear it would be. One of the things that I set myself as a task as a columnist was just to try to read Jeremy Corbyn's speeches, the books of people like Ralph Miliband and, you know, the speeches of John McDonnell, so I could explain to readers what it was that Jeremy Corbyn actually stood for. And I wrote it very neutrally, and I often got a lot of kickback from Corbynite supporters, furious that I was attacking Jeremy Corbyn when all I was doing literally was repeating a speech that he'd made. And that is because I think a lot of his supporters didn't realise quite what his politics were. And I think as time had gone on, problem, which was already a problem by 2019, would have got worse.
I mean, in answer to Keith, I mean, what would have happened if Jeremy Corbyn was still leader of the Labour Party and he'd had to get up yesterday to answer the Prime Minister's statement about Iran's aerial missile bombardment of Israel? Whose side would he have been on?
Peace.
Yeah, quite. I mean, this is a man. This is a man. This is a man who's famously hostile to Israel, supported by a lot of people who are just anti-Semites. Who himself has appeared on the Iranian government-backed press TV as an enthusiastic spokesman. Whose side would he have been on? I mean, it would have been an absolute debacle for the Labour Party. So you just have to take an example like that to show that what the consequences would be if he were still leader. We would be in shreds going into the next election.
I think this is a piece of party management that Keir Starmer will have to face after the election, just perennially. There will be a story, like, even if he wins a huge majority, there will be a narrative of the far left that says, oh, well, you could have won a larger majority if you'd been more radical. But there will also be a narrative that says, well, you didn't need that big majority. You could have been more radical. And we know that whatever Daily Mail readers might not have voted for you, but you could have got a mandate with a majority of 40 for real socialism. And the left will really struggle with a Labour victory, and they will be competing between those two narratives. There will always be a sense that Keir Starmer's sort of safety first, bomb-proof election campaign missed the opportunity to get a mandate for true transformation or hegemonic change or something, and that will be used as a stick to beat him with however much he wins.
The interesting question would be whether one of the people who thinks that is Keir Starmer. So does Keir Starmer himself think, maybe I could have been a bit more radical and got a smaller majority? Tony Blair didn't want to be more radical because that wasn't his politics. Yeah. But it is Keir Starmer's politics, at least in the past.
He did want to be more radical, Danny. He just didn't want to be more left-wing.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Correctly put.
Well, great question. Done. Thank you for that, Keith. If you want to send us a question, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. You can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. If you want to come and see us live, go to mytimesplus.co.uk. That was How to Win an Election.